I'm Allison Kulo.
And I'm Doug Wells. Welcome to Mound Money on KPCW.
Conversations about the future of work tend to focus on banalities. Self-driving robotized means deliberately ignoring the fact that too many people are being left behind. Future of work thought leader Bill Jensen changes the conversation in his latest book, The Day Tomorrow Said No, The Discovery That Forever Changed the Future and How We Work. The Day Tomorrow Said No is an illustrated fable where characters today, tomorrow, and little ones save the future. Actual future-focused trends and data drive both the story and a completely new understanding of how work is and how it will continue to change. Bill Jensen is the founder of the Jensen Group and a leading speaker and consultant around the future of work. He is globally ranked as top five thought leader in the future of work, transformational leadership, and digital transformation. He brings over 35 years of experience and research in solving leaders' toughest challenges to this book and creates a new path to hope, redemption, and more amazing futures for all. Bill, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
Well, there's quite a bit for us to talk about this morning. Let's start with you sharing with the audience a bit of your background and what led you to write this book.
Well, as you mentioned in the intro, I've been working in organizational change for over 35 years, and the last 10 or so has been totally ramped up as far as how technology is being leveraged to change our future. So the future of work 10 years ago was completely different than it is now, and the pandemic really changed everything. So this was written before and then during the pandemic, and it's about what is post-pandemic life going to be like as we work?
Well, and give our audience some thoughts. What are some of those changes, and why should we be talking about them now?
Well, Doug, the biggest change, I would say, I started to share before the pandemic, and people poo-pooed it. Oh, this isn't going to be real. There's statistics out there that says in the next 20 years, we are going to experience more change than we have in the past 2000. Now, if you do the math, that depending on how much tech you use, that comes down to a lifetime's worth of change in a year to 2 or 3 years. And everybody said, oh, that's never going to happen. And then the pandemic happened. And yes, we've had a lifetime's worth of change happen within 1 year. So that's definitely going to be affecting all of us. And then it's not just the technology, it's how much things are changing around us. Two-thirds of the kids who are in school today, they will be working in jobs that do not exist today. That's how drastic that change is going to happen. So we need to start thinking very differently about how we prepare for the future.
So you talk about how the conversation of the future of work needs to change. What is wrong with the current conversation and what needs to change about it?
Well, even before, Allison, before we get into the future of work, just think about the last year with the pandemic. And we saw, and the top news story that I just heard in the NPR play in before, you know, mortgages and rent are, you know, there's no more forgiveness on it. And people now are going to be facing foreclosures and being thrown out of their homes. Now, that's not affecting everyone. That's affecting especially the lower end of the marketplace. So we have up to 40% of our workforce that are really struggling, maybe being kicked out of their homes. And they were affected by the fact that people in knowledge and service work, which is you, the three of us, we can do our jobs remotely, are different than, let's say, a janitor or a cook or a waitress that have to be face-to-face with their jobs. So the people on lower ends, on service work, where they have to be face-to-face, are really, really struggling right now.
Yeah, so give us some examples of the type of jobs that are likely going away, and what needs to happen to make sure that the people that were doing those jobs can still make a good living?
Well, you know, the one statistic that's cited often is truck drivers. We have millions of people out on our roads right now delivering things, and we're about to enter the era of self-driving vehicles. And that's going to impact less of us as consumers and more everything that gets trucked. Most of the people who drive for a living, you know, as far as delivery, many of them are going to go away. And it's not just the fact that jobs are going to go away. More and more of our jobs are changing. I've written 9 books, and I've done many NPR-driven interviews, and I always had to drive to the station. Well, for you guys, I just had to upload an app. And I'm talking to you through an app that I had to upload.
That's our secret. The audience doesn't know you're not here because the app is so good. Isn't that incredible?
But I literally had to go to every single station wherever I was. They wouldn't let me dial in. And now I'm using an app. So it's changing. That's the wonderful side. I don't have to drive to your studio to be there. But the downside is, you know, that people are really need to be, as I said, you know, waitresses, cooks, things like that. There is no app for that. You need to be face to face. So it's going to most affect the people who need to be face to face, whether it's home care workers or other things. More and more the technology is going to be challenging our workloads.
Well, unfortunately for truck drivers, it looks like there is going to be an app for driving trucks. It's going to be fully automated truck driving. But what I like to think about is the derivative impacts of stuff like that. I mean, I think that's a future that we all can see. But as I take road trips and during the pandemic, instead of getting on an airplane to go somewhere, I would drive. I like to go to San Diego. We'd rent a house and hunker down in San Diego, right? Mm-hmm. And I would drive there. And I found myself wondering, what happens to these little towns that are 200 miles apart that really right now thrive on, you know, the highway break business, for lack of a better term? What happens to the little cafes, the little gas stations along the highway when truck drivers are no longer stopping for a meal?
Exactly. And what you're talking about happened over the past few decades with big box stores, you know, the Walmarts of the world versus, you know, the mom and pop stores. But your question is very relevant. Those jobs will go away. The challenge is the reskilling for new jobs. You can get a GED equivalent person working in, you know, as a counter person in that small independent cafe. But it's going to be different education needs to go work somewhere else. So the challenge is not just that the jobs will go away, it's the education and training and development that all of us are going to need.
And who bears the brunt of that cost of the education and development of people who need to be reskilled?
It's in theory, it should be borne by, you know, all of our employers. The large employers can deal with that, but they're also going to automate a lot of it. But it's also going to, for the smaller mom and pop stores or locations, they're not going to be able to train and develop their people.
So let's start going towards your book here, and that, you know, you decided to address and change the discussion of future work by writing an illustrated fable. So again, this isn't your typical business book. This is truly, you know, each page had, you know, graphic that correlated with the story, and it's not a long book, but it's important with what it says and what it's letting readers know.
Well, I wanted it to be data driven, and we can come back to that, but it's based on real future of work data. But I also have known through my career that the way all of us throughout all humanity have learned is storytelling. Whether it's church or synagogues or mosques putting, you know, visualizations up on their walls or in their stained glass, or whether it's been, you know, through art and museums. Throughout human history, all of us learn through the art of storytelling. And the reason I wrote this book, I was tired of trying to, I felt like Chicken Little saying, you know, to the senior leaders, the sky is falling, we need to change. And they said, yeah, but we have more things that are more urgent. So I took the idea of a fable, which is universal in all cultures. And I said, what if tomorrow said no? One of the data points in there is that we're running out of dreams. Only less than 10% of us can achieve our dreams where we currently work. So as the character tomorrow is interacting with the character today, for the first time in human history, she says, no, I'm not taking the handoff from you to today. I need you to do more work in today to make sure we have a future, to make sure we have dreams. And it goes from there. But it's a very compelling, easily understood story that's written for senior executives. But I've had school teachers down to fifth grade using this book to create conversations about the future of work.
Well, let's talk about that. I want to get back to some of the facts, but I want to talk about the work that needs to be done today to prepare. And, you know, we're based here in Park City, Utah. I moved here 25, 30 years ago from California. One of the things that struck me when I moved here was just how approachable the leaders of the state and the leaders of the city are to different ideas. In California, it would be very hard if you wanted to meet with the governor. When I moved here, and I think still to this day, if somebody has a good business idea, you know, people on the governor's staff are going to listen to you. And if it's a good idea, they're going to try to make it happen. And Utah's really a hotbed right now for a lot of exciting things. And the credit for that goes to the work that the state was doing 20 years ago. You mentioned earlier, we're going to have a lifetime worth of change, or at least 10 years worth of change in the next 2 to 3 years. What types of things do states need to do, do local governments need to do, to get, and employers need to do to make sure that our citizens have the skills that they need to be able to achieve their goals?
I don't know if the two of you have ever watched the TV show, The Undercover Boss.
Yes.
But it's where the employer thinks everything's going great, and then he puts on some costume or shaves his head or does whatever, he or she, the boss, and goes in and actually does the work. The reason I'm answering, Doug, your question this way is the core behind that show, the essence of what it is empathy. The most important thing, whether we're talking government leaders, corporate institutional leaders, not-for-profits, is one of the, I work in consulting and change consulting, and one of the biggest things that I find helps leaders most is I ask them to be a frontline worker for the day. And they suddenly go, wow, I never realized it was so hard. So the answer to your question, I'm going to obviously stay away from the politics of it. We all need to stop being so divisive between each other and start working together with each other. But beyond that, it's start really being empathetic to all the people whose lives are being affected by everything. Do your own version of undercover boss, whether it's government or corporate or not-for-profit. Do the frontline jobs for a day. Go work in a soup kitchen. Go work with homeless. Really understand the problems you're trying to solve. Most of us are too far removed from the problems we're trying to solve, and we're dealing with statistics or just data analysis of there's X percent in homeless. Go really understand what it's like, whatever your problem you're trying to solve. Live the life of the people who are living it, and you have a much greater chance at solving it.
Who's best to hear that message? Is it CEOs, or what level within an organization is best to listen to that message and follow through on those actions?
Well, the people with the power to change these things quickly. It all depends on how urgently we want to address it. If it needs to be addressed very quickly, we've got to approach the senior people. If we have time, which in most of these instances, environment, work, healthcare, we do not have a lot of time. Where the voices are going to come from is up from the bottom. So any kind of change that ultimately is successful is often driven by the masses or voices of the masses. So that's why in the book there are three main, it's called the three B's, the way to solve this. But one of them is the believers. And the believers are not just, we all need more and more believers. And that's not just, rah, rah, we can do it. That is. We do need people who are enthusiastic about what we're trying to achieve. But the believers are also like, let's say, Greta Thunberg in Sweden, a teenager who's protesting about climate change. We all need to get our voices heard to push. So the ultimate answer, Allison, to your question is bottom up, top down. Top down, we need power addressing things. Bottom up, we need much more vocal voices saying we need to change things.
Well, let's talk about those three B's. And I think Greta might actually fall into two categories. She's not just a believer, but she's willing to break things. She's willing to break the way the conversation is happening. And that took courage. And I think it's one of the reasons we've all really admired, for such a young person, the power of her conviction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And relating to the book, through part of my job, my first book 9 books ago was called Simplicity. So part of what I've done my entire career is I've tried to reduce everything to their simplest essence, all their components. What is the essence of the problem? And I tried to do that with how do we solve this future of work problem. I had the three characters, Today, Tomorrow, and Little One, travel through the future and analyze all the jobs we have. And it came down to, no matter what our job is throughout the world, no matter what we do for a living, there are only three basic jobs out there. There are the believers that I mentioned earlier, the ones that believe we can do it, but also protest when things are going wrong. They're the breakers. These are the Steve Jobs of the world, or the Elon Musks, that create completely new ways of doing things that we didn't have before. And then there's the builders, the people who build the systems. And as you mentioned, Doug, most of us are some combination of all three. We're not just one or the other. But it's to recognize that we need all three components. It's like we talk about diversity in the workplace. We need diversity of thought and thought leadership. We need more and more believers. We need more and more breakers. And we need more builders. And through that, we can achieve a better future.
So as you just said, making sure that you have a well-balanced team, would then someone be right in, when interviewing people, starting to look at I don't want to use the word category, but you know, what kind of a category a person would fall into? I mean, we don't want everyone with the same thought process.
Exactly. In the same way that organizations now interview for diversity of color, of religion, of ability. It's also looking for team building or company building, organization building of those three different components. Exactly, we need all three. And the challenge is efficiency needs the status quo. We don't like the troublemaker. We don't like people speaking up. No, we don't have time to address that. In reality, those are the believers that we need speaking up more and more to say, hey, things aren't going as well as they should be. We need to fix this.
Yes, Steve Jobs was a great visionary, but he was not such a great employee. I understand he was difficult to supervise, as anybody can probably imagine. You know, one of the ways you get people to change is you share with them facts that, you know, empathy is important, but to get the empathy, you need to understand what the facts are as well. And your book shares a number of facts that were surprising to me, one of which is that only 1 in 10 people are able to achieve their goals and their dreams through their careers, or at least I should say their career goals. What are some other, share with our audience some of the other facts, a few of the other facts that might be surprising the people that you share in your book?
Well, as I mentioned, two-thirds of the kids that are in school today are going to be going into jobs that simply do not exist today. So that is huge. We need to start thinking completely differently about how we prepare for work. And when we also talk about the future of work, we have a very uneven economy that basically opportunities are lagging. So I cite some statistics that, again, up to 40% of us are, the future of the economy could be great for many of us, but there's at least 40% of us that are really going to be struggling. And I've done some research on the future of HR, which is human resources, and I've asked people, you know, how do you see your ability to keep up with the amount of the change that's happening? And 75%, 3 in 4, see the future of work pushing them beyond their outer limits, beyond their capacity. So we really need to think about things differently. For example, that brings up wellness. As we've seen recently with a world-class tennis player in the French Open and now in the Olympics, world-class performers are now saying, hey, my mental health also matters. So when 3 and 4 see the future of work pushing them beyond their outer limits, what's going to happen in more and more organizations is wellness, not just wellness, which is healthcare, but well-being, our overall well-being due to stress is going to have to be addressed. So well-being and wellness are going to keep coming up as a more and more important issue.
As we get towards the end of our time, I wanted to have you, you know, change the perspective of our conversation just a tiny bit, because we've been talking about, you know, speaking to employers and people who are in organizations. What should, you know, us, you know, employees, how should we be looking at this? What's most beneficial, that message that you can share with workers?
Well, I did not mention by name, but the Olympian was Simone Biles. We need to be more Simone Biles-like when we say, hey, this is beyond my capacity. We've been dealing with things for decades and so just sucking it up. Oh, you know, do it for the cause, do it for the family, do it for the... No, you can't take care of others unless you're taking care of yourself. So the most important thing you can do for you is recognize what are your dreams, write them down, journal, do some journaling. What are you passionate about? Are you achieving your dreams where you currently work? If not, what could you do differently? Start journaling, do some reading on wellness and well-being, but make sure you are living your best life. The one thing we can do, I spoke about believers. You've got to believe in you first. So the most important thing is take a stand for you, your mental wellness, your financial well-being, your emotional well-being, and start caring about you first and foremost. If you're going to take care of family members or others, first you need to be taken care of. So the most important thing we can all do is recognize we were put on this planet for a reason. Make sure you're fulfilling that reason, whatever it is.
Yeah, that's a good point for us to end on. I think one of the takeaway points for all of us during the Olympics is seeing our superstars admit that they're human too, and they need to take care of themselves. And I think I feel bad that Simone Biles is going through this, but I think through her honesty and transparency, a lot of good's going to come from that. And I think a lot of good's going to come from your book as well. I think we're going to be beginning this conversation sooner. You started at the beginning of the conversation saying you felt a little bit like Chicken Little saying the sky's falling and nobody's listening. And we certainly hope that your book, The Day Tomorrow Said No, The Discovery That Forever Changed the Future and How We Work, we hope that that's one of the early warning shots for all of us. Bill Jensen, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Thank you for listening to Mound Money. Please visit kpcw.org for more information.